July 1937, the world's most famous woman pilot disappears during her attempt to circumnavigate the globe. In 1988, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, a small nonprofit known by its acronym TIGER, began a science-based investigation of the Earhart disappearance. Decades of forensic research and a dozen South Pacific expeditions have now produced hard evidence from multiple disciplines to provide the long-sought answer to the riddle. In this series of conversations with Joan Sachs, TIGER Executive Director Rick Gillespie takes us step by step through the adventures, the setbacks, and the discoveries that uncover the evidence that has solved aviation history's greatest mystery.
Hi, I'm Joan Sachs. Like many of you, I've read newspaper and magazine articles and watched television documentaries about TIGER's adventures and discoveries. As a member of TIGER, I've participated in research, and I know there's so much more to the story that's never been told. I've known Rick Gillespie and his wife, TIGER co-founder Pat Thrasher, for many years, and so when Rick asked me to help him bring the behind-the-scenes story of TIGER's Earhart expeditions to the public, I enthusiastically agreed. Over the years, there have been 12 TIGER expeditions to the South Pacific, and we've organized the podcast into 12 seasons. The episodes in season one tell the story of the first trip in 1989. Season two deals with the next expedition in 1991, and so on. To follow the progress of the investigation, you'll want to listen to the episodes and seasons in order. For newcomers, we make it easy to catch up with the story so far by publishing a compilation at the end of each season. Now, let's get to the next episode. Hello, Rick. In the last episode, we left nine members of the 1997 expedition team marooned in Funafuti.
Funafuti, yes, indeed. Technically, the Funafuti is the entire atoll, and the one island that has a village on it is Fungafala. So we were in Fungafala, Funafuti.
I feel like I should say God bless.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so it sounds funny to us. It doesn't sound funny to them. We had come off an expedition that didn't turn out the way we thought it would. We didn't find anything. We still didn't know where the airplane went off the reef and into the water. We were quite sure that that's what happened, that they landed on the reef, sent radio distress calls for several days, and then were washed into the ocean. We thought maybe into the lagoon, but we hadn't been able to find anything in the ocean, and we didn't find anything in the lagoon. So we didn't know where this happened, because there's lots of places on that reef where you could land an airplane. But the worst aspect of the expedition was that we had been hit by two tropical cyclones. There was one cyclone that didn't hit us directly, but created such dangerous sea conditions at the island that just getting people off and on the island through the landing channel was harrowing, to say the least. And then on the way home, we ran smack dab into another tropical cyclone that prevented us from getting back to Fiji. We were experiencing 45-foot seas, extremely high winds. We were starting to lose pieces off the boat. We were making no headway, so we had to run for sheltered water. And the only sheltered water was Funafuti. And it was about 300 miles off our course, so we had to turn, which then put the seas on our port quarter, which...
How long a trip, once you made the turn, was it?
It was another couple days to get to Funafuti. But we did get there. We got into the lagoon. Water was still pretty choppy in the lagoon. Funafuti, Fungafala, has an airport, and it has airline service. And we knew that, and we said, okay, we'll just get off here and catch the airline back to Fiji and get our flight home. Mm. We got in there. There was indeed a flight going out that afternoon, but they only had three seats left. So we put three people that had to get out. We put our archaeologist on the plane, another team member that had to be back to work, and then my wife Pat went on the plane so that she could get in touch with everybody's family and be the liaison. But we expected that the rest of us, the other nine of us, could get out the next day.
They had a scheduled flight every day.
Well, not every day, but in this particular case, they did have flights going out of there to Fiji 2 days in a row.
So it just happened. Makes sense.
We expected that we'd be able to get on that flight and everything would be cool. Except on the flight down to Fiji, one of the propellers on the plane malfunctioned and the plane was grounded. And in order to get a new prop, the prop would have to come from, I think I've got this right, Australia, and a mechanic to install it would have to come from New Zealand, and this would all have to be done in Fiji, and nobody could say how long that was going to take.
Wow.
The airline had one other airplane, and that was up in the Marshall Islands, but the crew's employment contract had run out, and they had left.
So the plane was sitting there crewless.
So the plane was sitting there crewless, and we were sitting in Funafuti clueless. So, you know, that's the way it was. Okay, well, where do you stay in Funafuti?
Yeah.
Well, there was one hotel.
No question then.
Yeah. The Travelodge. And it's not a bad hotel by Pacific standards. But they had experienced the same storm everybody else did, and they had not been resupplied for a long time. And they were pretty much out of stuff. All they really had left was mutton. And while we were there, we had mutton in every shape and form you can imagine. But that's what there was. Funafuti's an interesting place. It's part of the nation of Tuvalu, and which is mostly just these little atolls with subsistence cultures. But the one place that's built up at all, Fongafala on Funafuti in Tuvalu, has no industry. But the government does run satellite relays, these huge satellite dishes. Primarily at that time, they were doing satellite relays for phone sex in the United States. Now, the operators weren't there doing the phone sex. This is just providing linkage for the calls. That's what we were told anyway. I mean, God knows. So that's really the only industry there was and the only income for the country.
Wow.
But there was no unemployment there because they were really great at creating jobs. They just were experts at taking any job and turning it into about a dozen jobs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, give you an example. I mean, in the hotel, ordering lunch, kind of like going to a closing on a house. There were these things you had to, paperwork you had to do and sign things, and several different people had to take care of this.
Oh, my. To serve you mutton.
To serve you some mutton. Okay. This is before satellite phones, okay?
Uh-huh.
So we want to make an international phone call. So to do that, you went to the telephone office. You told the clerk the number you wanted to call, and she would write that down. And then she would take it into another room and give it to someone who would then calculate the permanent charge for the call that you wanted to make. And then she would bring it back out and the clerk would inform you, that call is going to cost you so much per minute. And you'd say, okay, that's fine. So that person would then report to another person who assigned you one of the phones on the wall. That was going to be your call.
Still like in the same building?
Oh, yeah. No, it was all in the same room, really. Then an operator, another person, would put the call through, and then your assigned phone would ring. And you'd go over, and you'd pick up your phone, and you'd make your call. And then afterward, the person who calculated the cost of the call would report the total charge to the clerk, who is then going to collect the money from you. But you had to have exact change, because she didn't make change.
Oh.
It had to be exact amount, and you rarely did have exact change. So
was it in their money? What was the
currency? Actually, I think we use U.S. dollars mostly. But you would then have to go across the street to a store and buy something so that you could get the right change to come back and pay for your phone call.
Well, that's all really industrious of them.
Oh, it could take most of an afternoon to make a five-minute phone call. Yeah. Oh, that was the way it was on Funafuti.
How different was the time zone from the East Coast?
Well, let's see. Nicomororo. Okay. About 7 hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you went in the morning, you could get somebody during the day.
Yeah, yeah, you could get somebody. So here we are, obviously hoping they're going to get this airplane fixed and we're going to get out of here, because there's nothing to do on Funafuti. You can shoot pool in the hotel bar for 50 cents a game Australian, or you can watch Bollywood movies on the TV in the bar. Of course, they're in Hindu or Urdu or whatever, but they're still pretty entertaining. Yes. You don't need,
they are.
It's all the same plot.
It's music and dance.
Every Bollywood movie has the same plot.
Yeah.
The heroine who has an evil employer or landlord, or something, and then there's the hero that comes. Yeah. You know how it goes. Or you could rent a motorbike for $10 a day and drive it on the 2 miles of road up and down the little
just like the pigs and the kids did?
The what?
The kids and the pigs.
Everybody that goes back and forth across the runway and pigs and dogs sleep on the runway.
And so there's a road that is
You don't ride your bike. No, you can't ride your motorbike on the runway. You can cross the runway, but you can't go up and down the runway. But there is a road that goes from one end of the island to the other end.
And that's just 2 miles?
Yeah, it's a couple miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, the island itself is about 2 miles long, but you could almost throw a baseball across it. It's very narrow. Mm-hmm. We would ride it. It's just a crushed coral road. It's not paved.
Yeah.
But it's something to do. But mostly we'd go down to the airport office and we'd check. Now, the airline representative there, the agent, a guy named Nick, very nice guy. And we would say, "So, Nick, is the airplane coming?" And he says, "Oh, yes. Yes, the airplane is coming, but not today." Oh, the same thing every day, but not today. I mean, that kind of became a thing, you know.
I bet.
Okay. So you kept checking. And that was the worst thing about it, not knowing when this was going to end.
Sure.
It was kind of like being in the army, you know, and there's rumors, but you never know for sure. The ABC News film crew's sound man, his name was Kenny, got real tired of this. And he decided that he was going to solve the problem the way he solved problems back in L.A. And Kenny went down to the airline office and accosted Nick verbally, pounded his fist on the counter, and just made a real scene. Okay, so I'm out riding my bike, and somebody comes running up to me and says, "Rick, you got to get back to the hotel. The Minister of Transportation needs to talk to you right away."
Oh, my.
Okay, now what? So I go back to the hotel. And the Minister of Transportation is there, and he's furious. And he says, "Your man, Kenny, is down in the airline office. And if you don't get him under control, we're going to put him in jail. And you don't want to be in a Tuvalu jail. Trust me." I said, "Yeah, I trust you." The ABC News producer was there with me, Howie. I said, "Howie, we got to get Kenny." He says, "Yeah, we got to get Kenny." So we went down to the office and we got our hands on Kenny and dragged him back to the hotel and locked him in his room. There was a lot of bad feeling about this because the ugly American had caused a scene, and this is not good. So I went to one of the wait staff in the the many wait staff in the hotel, who I knew spoke English quite well. And I asked her, I said, so in Tuvaluan, how would you say devil? And she said, oh, that would be anganga. Okay, and how would you say white? Oh, that's parangi. So anganga parangi would be white devil, right? And she said, yeah. Why are you, it's okay, never mind. So I went back down to the airline office, and Nick is sitting there just fuming. And I said, Nick, I just wanted to let you know that from now on, Kenny will be known as Anganga Parangi. And he about fell off his chair. He thought that was about the funniest thing he'd heard. And the word got around the aisle, oh, Kenny Anganga Parangi. And it turned the whole thing into a joke. And we were cool.
Well, how about Kenny? How was he?
We let Kenny cool his heels for a while and let him be known that he was going to behave himself or he was going to be in a lot of trouble with us. So far, you know, nothing constructive was getting done.
So what day was this? How many days?
Oh, I think we're like 4 or 5 days into this thing.
Wow.
We get to talk. We talk to everybody. You know, a little place like that, you talk to everybody. And we're talking to the manager of the hotel, a lovely young woman named Risasi Finicasso. And she wanted to know what we were doing, of course. You know, how's this? All these Americans show up and, you know, are stuck here. And we explained that we had just come from Nicomoraro in Kiribati, and we were looking for evidence of Amelia Earhart. And
Did she know who she was?
No, she had never heard of Amelia Earhart. But we explained it, and she thought that was all interesting. And she went, well, you know, that is interesting because, you know, I was born on Nicomoraro. I said,
what?
Say what?
Really?
She says, yeah, I was, my family was there at the time I was born. It was the early 1950s. I've forgotten the exact year, but early 50s.
Why was her family there?
Well, she was Tuvaluan, and in that time, the Tuvalu was the Ellis Islands, and Ellis Islanders are a different ethnic group than the Gilbert Islanders, the Kiribati people. The Tuvaluans are Polynesians, and the Gilbertese, Kiribati people, are Micronesians. The British always thought that the Ellis Islanders were sharper, and so they would get the training for things like carpenters and radio operators and police and things like that. Risasi was telling us about Nicomoraro and the traditions on Nicomoraro, and she was quite familiar with the Gilbertese traditions on Nicomoraro, which is a bit unusual for the Ellis Islanders because they didn't hold much with the Gilbertese traditions.
How long did she live there? So was she there as a...
She was there for about 10 years,
okay,
I think.
So...
Yeah. We asked Risasi if she'd ever heard of Nicomoraro's supposed guardian goddess, ancestor. She says, oh, you mean Nemanjerabuka? I said, yes, that's exactly who we mean. Because we knew all about Nemanjerabuka. We'd been told about her. Now, okay, I should explain about Nemanjerabuka. All of the islands of the Gilbert Islands at that time, and maybe still do, traditionally had guardian ancestor. And one of these ancestors was Nemanjerabuka. Now, Ne is simply like Ms. It's just a female thing. Nemanjerabuka. And Manjerabuka means old woman of the buka trees. And in Gilbertese tradition, Nemanjerabuka taught the people of the Gilbert Islands long distance canoe travel. Very powerful ancestor who came from an island called Nicomoraro in Gilbertese tradition. Okay, so back in 1937, when the British expedition came to what was known as Gardiner Island to evaluate it for future settlement the party that was accompanying the two English Colonial Service officers, Harry Maude and Eric Bevington, 16 Gilbertese elders. And they knew all the old traditions, of course. And they look at this island that's covered with buka trees. And they said, we know where this is. This is Nikumaroro, the home of Nimanyinabuka. And that's how the island got its modern name. Yeah, that's the story.
So it was originally a myth? The island was a myth?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
It wasn't a myth to them. Yeah, I mean, right. any more than Mount Olympus was a myth to the Greeks.
Right.
You know, that's where the gods are from. Well, Nemanjinabuka was from Nikumaroro, and this is obviously Nikumaroro. That means Nemanjinabuka is here.
Wow.
And this is serious stuff now. That's why in the expeditions, we always had to put our hands in the sand and touch the sand to our faces.
I do remember that.
So that Nemanjinabuka would come and sniff us. We thought it was the wind blowing, but it was her sniffing us. And as long as we smelled like the island, she would not molest us. Okay, that's why it's so important. Risasi was very familiar. Oh, yes, Nemanjinabuka. She said, do you know Nemanjinabuka's chant? I said, what? Oh, yeah, there's a chant. I know her chant. Everybody knew Nemanjinabuka's chant. And she actually wrote it down for us.
So it was something she learned as a little girl.
Oh, yeah, she learned it. And I'm going to do as much as I can remember of the Tuvalu, and I'm going to butcher it, but Te Yangoro Te Karo Bak Bak Okay, and it goes on and on. It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
I'm just reading what she wrote down. And what it means, well, translated, it's blow strong winds, rainfall, lightning, coming with thunder, roaring her footsteps, her traveling from abode in Nirabu, that's Nemanjinabuka. Stronger. Welcome. Over there is your opponent. That's Nemanjinabuka's chant.
Wow.
You know, she's coming and she seems to be kind of pissed. And don't be pissed at me, your opponent's over there. And so, wow, this is really fascinating stuff.
Was that part of the tradition when you enter the island, or did they do that as part of a religious ceremony?
I don't know when people on the island would say that. But, you know, make reference to this place called Nirabu. And we later figured out where Nirabu is.
On
Nikumaroro. It's down by the Southern Lagoon Passage.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So there we are on Funafuti, and suddenly we're learning things that...
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's
and
amazing.
So we're talking to Risasi. You're looking for this American woman who disappeared in an airplane? I have a friend, she's a little older than I am, who, worth asking her if she knows anything about this, because she was...
Was she there the same time?
Yeah, she was. Wow. She was there on the island. She's a little older than I am, and so she might remember things that I don't. And next day, we talked to Risasi. She says, Tapania wants to talk to you.
Interesting.
So, okay. So we go and we see Tapania Teaki. Well, I did see pieces of an airplane. Where?
Really?
Well, she says some of them were washed up on the shoreline, but others were, there was a piece of a wing out on the reef flat in the water.
Really?
I can show you where. We had a map, and she marked a place on the map down near the main lagoon passage. We thought that was pretty interesting because we knew that wreckage from the shipwreck, the Norwich City,
right,
was distributed north from the northwest to the southeast. That's the prevailing path of... Well, that's where storms drive things.
Yeah.
That's very clear. So if you've got a wing there, it came from up there. So this is our first hint that maybe up there is where the airplane went into the water.
And had you ever looked in that area?
No, back in 1991 when we did a sonar survey around the island looking for the airplane, the one underwater area we couldn't search was that area off the northwest end, because that's where they ran the sonar fish into an underwater obstacle and lost it.
Oh, okay.
So that was the one place we had never done any underwater sonar work. Hmm. So we're thinking, wow, for the first time, now we've got some hint of
where
this landing may have taken place. And then my father also remembers something. Well, her father had been the island school teacher, again, a Tuvaluan with special skills.
Yeah.
His name was Pulakai Sangavalu.
Is he still alive?
And he was still alive, but she cautioned us that, oh, he's very old and he's very senile and you can't. He seemed fine. he was maybe having a good day, but he said, yes, I saw a piece of, from an airplane, I don't know what kind of airplane, but it was on the shore of the lagoon, and he marked the place. It's on a little peninsula across from the main lagoon passage. So some floating piece of wreckage that was washed through the passage would logically wash up on that peninsula.
Yeah.
That's where he said he saw it, this thing. And I said, well, what do you think? Oh, I just assumed it was something from the war. Yeah, because this is after World War II, and he hadn't been there during the war. And so, whoa, okay. What happened to it? Well, people salvaged it. You know, people took pieces that were useful. And we knew that people were doing that with airplane wrecks. We'd found lots of scraps in the old village. Suddenly, we've got information that we never had before. And Funafuti wasn't a complete loss after all. It was one of the luckiest things that happened to us.
Wow. So you're not planning your next trip already?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we got to check out this. We got to get out there. After we got home, is there any way we can verify this anecdote that Tapania told us about airplane wreckage on the reef? And this? Well, we've got aerial mapping photos that were taken in 1953. And it's a whole series of photos that overlap each other, like you do with aerial mapping photos. Maybe our forensic imaging expert, Jeff Glickman, who made it possible for us to find the tank that didn't turn out to be an airplane fuel tank,
but he found
that tank in aerial photos. Maybe he can find something in the aerial mapping photos. And so Jeff went to work, and sure enough, he found, I think it was a total of four objects, light-colored objects on the reef in that area that appear in two overlapping photos. So you know it's not a flaw in the,
in the
negative
film,
or a fleck of dust. They're giving us what's called a specular reflection. They're metal. And there's nothing on that shipwreck that's going to be shiny metal. I should have mentioned, when we were talking to Tapania about the piece of a wing she saw on the reef, I asked her, what color was it? And she pointed to the ceiling, the underside of the aluminum roof on their house.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's the right color.
Yeah. Things are adding up.
Yeah. It turned out that the great Funafuti marooning was. And the plane did come. And we did get out of there.
Oh, my.
And,
how long ultimately were you there?
Oh, we were there for 6 days. 6 days.
And you went back to Fiji, and
we went back to Fiji and caught flights back to the United States and lived happily ever after.
Until the next trip.
Until the next trip.
So when you got back, how much longer before you planned to go again? Did you right away set out with?
We always set out thinking that, well,
when
we obviously need to go back, and how are we going to go back, and where in God's name, where are we going to find the money to go back?
Always that.
But then something happened that changed everything.
What?
New evidence cropped up that sent us to another island.
Really?
An expedition to a different island. And we'll talk about that in the next episode.
Oh my, okay. I'm anxious to hear that. I didn't realize. Okay, well, thank you, Rick. We'll talk to you next time.
You bet.
Thanks for listening. The Earhart Expeditions is a serial history of Tiger's 12 expeditions to the South Pacific. We release a new episode each Tuesday. You can receive special bonus episodes and get access to Tiger's extensive video library by becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to Patreon, that's Patreon, and search on Tiger, Tiger. You can also be a part of the adventure and participate in research. Go to tiger.org and click on Join Tiger. See you next Tuesday.